Hi there, you're listening to the Searching for Good podcast, the show where I interview good people to find out what makes them so good. For more information on the podcast or for the show notes for this episode, just go to searchingforgoodpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a review if you've found the episodes to be helpful in your life. And now, please welcome your host, me. Hi there, my name's Simon Drew, and welcome to the Searching for Good podcast. And before I get into the introduction, I have to apologize. I know that I've been very inconsistent with getting episodes out on time. I know that we're definitely about maybe 3 or 4 weeks behind at the moment, so I do apologize for that. No excuses, it's all my fault. But I'm hoping that in the future we'll be able to get episodes out on time and more episodes to you. But for now, you know, last time on the podcast, I interviewed the wonderful Daniel and Sarah Lovelace, and they just gave so much value in that interview. It was so great to hear from them. And when I asked Daniel who he would recommend to have on this podcast, he told me about a couple of people. One in particular was this guy called Maxwell Moore. And, you know, after hearing a little bit more about Maxwell, I was so excited to talk to him. And I can tell you now that after having done the interview with him, you know, I went from excited to talk to him to being an absolute advocate for this man and everything that he's trying to achieve with his life. So a little bit about Maxwell. Well, Max actually grew up in Tennessee, and then he went on to join the military, and he worked as a medic on board ships for about 16 years. And when he came out of the military, he actually took a hobby of his, which was making soaps, and he turned that into a business with a purpose. Now, it's called Maxwell Soaps, and you have to go to the website. It's called maxwellsoaps.com. That's Maxwell's Soaps, with an S after the Maxwell. And you have to check this out. It's just such a great company. What he does is basically every time they sell a soap, they give a soap to a homeless person as well. Because he really believes in the power of just being able to be clean. That's such a basic human right. And also, he also focuses on giving jobs to veterans. So it's such an incredible story. And I really can't wait to really dive into his life and let you hear all about his life, because I just got so much value out of this interview. And I know that you're going to get the same. So I will put all of the notes for this episode and also the links to Max's website all in the show notes for this podcast. So you can actually go to my website and find all of those details. So without further ado, I'd love to introduce you to the incredible and amazing person who we're talking to today, Maxwell Moore. So Max, welcome to the show. I've been so excited to talk to you because you just seem like you've had such an interesting life, and you know, Daniel and Sarah couldn't have said enough good about you. And so I thought, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what you do and why you do it.
Right. Well, thanks for having me on. As you said, my name is Maxwell Moore, Max Moore. And I am the head gorilla at Maxwell's Soaps. We're a for-profit company that makes high-end soap here in Los Angeles, and everything is, you know, owned and operated by veterans, and everything is locally sourced. And every time we sell a bar of soap, we donate one back to homeless hygiene programs here in Los Angeles and San Francisco. We are expanding as we speak to other locations through the states, doing a sort of franchising model, empowering veterans to use this product to, you know, make themselves gainfully employed. And why do I do this? I do this because I believe in fighting for what's right. I believe that in, you know, such a rich country, we shouldn't have people who, you know, have to walk around without a shower. I do this because I spent 16 years in the military. I believe in my country, and not as some nationalist sort of idea, but more like I believe in taking care of my tribe, you know, and I would feel that way wherever I was at. And after coming home from, I guess I came home from Afghanistan, I'd been away for so many years, I sort of forgot and sort of lost touch with a lot of the problems that are happening in America. And I came home and I was asked by the girl at the checkout at the grocery store. She said, you know, would you give a dollar to fix hunger in America? And I remember getting like an attitude and saying, you know, a dollar, I'll give you 20. I sort of slammed the 20 on the counter and sort of sauntered off. And I didn't really know what I was angry about. And, you know, you asked me why it is I do what I do. I realized that I was angry because, as a combat veteran, I just sort of presumed, as I was gone for so long and so out of touch with America, I just sort of presumed that as hard as me and my brothers were fighting for making a difference for America overseas, I just sort of assumed that everybody else was working just as hard back here to make things better. And the idea that, you know, for all the war and all the work that I'd put in overseas, that we still had hungry people in America, just really lit a fire under my ass. And I'm fighting against American apathy is what I call it. You know, mm-hmm. this privilege and entitlement to just not give a fuck. Mm-hmm. And that's the fight I'm picking. You know, I'm poking people in their chest and saying, you know, if you come off of the freeway and see someone spare changing and asking for a handout, and the best you can come up with is, you know, to ignore it or throw a little money at it, or, you know, look down like a passive animal in a fight, I just don't really abide that very much at all. And I want to bring that, you know, fighting spirit that was drilled into me with the Navy and Marine Corps overseas. I want to bring that fight back here and make this place better. I want to see us impact real change on a real problem in my lifetime. I want to see things fixed, you know, for the efforts that we're putting into it. So that's why I'm a problem solver.
Wow. I love everything about that story. I'm so excited to get into all of the details and find out more about the company, and also find out more about your time in the military. Mm-hmm. For now, I really want to go right back to the start. And could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you think it really molded you as a person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in mostly in Tennessee, mm-hmm. in a town called Knoxville. I grew up in the ghetto side of East Knoxville, but my only sort of refuge from that as a kid was being up in the hills, in the mountains, Smoky Mountains, of the Appalachia. And so being around country people and being country people, my family was just it's a family of DIYers, you know. We grew our own weed, we mm-hmm. we made our own moonshine, we fixed our own cars.
Wow.
We did our own electrical work. We never called out for, you know, we never called out for anyone to fix or make anything, you know, for us. And I grew up in Tennessee, and then my mother got into grad school, and my father went from being an electrician to being an electrical contractor. And we moved out to a town called Claremont, California, which is a very liberal sort of Ivy League college town, just mm-hmm. outside Los Angeles. And, you know, tree-lined streets and, you know, huge college libraries and campuses. And so I kind of came from, you know, poor country ghetto folks, and understood the power of self-sufficiency, and understood the power of being able to elevate yourself by elevating your mind, by educating yourself.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And In my experience, I mean, I grew up in the country as well. Not quite as in the country as you did, but in my experience, people who have grown up in the country always have amazing stories from their childhood. And so I was wondering if you could possibly tell us, like, the first story or memory that comes to your mind of growing up in that area.
I remember I remember fishing with my grandfather actually on the plantation. I mean, my grand my so I should say my father is black and my mother is white. And I guess that's relatively common now, but in the late 70s, early 80s in Southern American states, that wasn't very common. And so I remember the Klan slashing my dad's tires. That was a real memory that stuck with me, that kind of crabs in the bucket sort of hate. But I also remember, like, my grandfather teaching me how to fish, and we were fishing in a lake on the plantation that was originally this land. It was the slave plantation that my family was slaves on, and now my family owns that property. And so I don't know, it's been a very I don't know, it's been a real interesting American experience for me, being mixed race, being from the South, moving to Southern California, being in the military, seeing the world that way, and then settling in Los Angeles. But I think that those first memories of being a Southern, boy, being both living in the ghetto and living in the country. I remember having to bus across town in the, from east side of Knoxville to the west side of Knoxville, which was the black side versus the white side of town, because my mother wanted us to get a better education. So we had to get up, a full 2 hours earlier than we would have normally, so we could catch the crosstown bus. And there was a motel that backed up against our property. And every night when I would take out the garbage, that was my chore as a kid, I'd have to step over the used hypodermic needles of the junkies who would shoot up there at night. And then in the mornings, I would the hookers who worked the who were getting off shift would wait with me and my little sister, and wait for us to get on the bus. So it was a real melange of experiences, and I can't help but be really thankful. I recognize that I am the culmination of everyone I've met. I'm the culmination of all those experiences. And that's what I got.
Wow. You really do just have such an interesting perspective based on everything that makes you, like that's so incredible to me, the idea that your family used to be slaves on this plantation and now they own the property. And it's such an incredible story. And I want to actually focus on your parents now. And could you tell us about maybe a lesson or two that they taught you about life that's really stuck with you throughout your life?
Yeah, my parents were the by any means necessary type. They were really hard on me. There was a lot of physical discipline, a lot of corporal punishment, I got my ass whipped a lot, but I should say that, like, that was the culture. That's how I was brought up. So the lessons that my parents gave me were taught with pain, and not some gentle coaxing, but, like, discipline. And so my late mother started as a go-go dancer when she was 16 in New Orleans. And by the time that, she passed away, she was a professor of psychology at the local university. And my dad was born while polio was still an issue. you know, before we'd really sort of eradicated that problem. And he was a black man in Southern American states. And, you know, he didn't even have the benefit of being, of the physical prowess, you know, because he had this, he had a shrunken leg from his polio, an underdeveloped leg and a pretty significant limp because of it. So, but despite their beginnings, my parents never quit. And despite their, I mean, despite their issues, and they had plenty of them, from addictions and compulsions to, you know, anxieties and depressions and all of that, my parents still were real fighters, you know. And my mother believed in the power of education and enlightenment. And she believed that, you know, the one thing that the man can't take from you is your knowledge, you know. So there was never a time that I was allowed to not be reading a couple books at a time. And she taught me to question the rules and fight for what I believe in, not what someone else believes in. And my dad never missed a day of work, despite having a deformed leg. He climbed ladders for the electrical union for nearly 20 years before he opened his own business. And I mean, I worked right alongside of him all through high school, you know, climbing into attics and pulling wiring in the heat of the summer, and climbing under houses and pulling wire through the cold of the winter. And so I by the time I was ready to leave the house and go into the Navy, they'd also financed a semester abroad to Italy, and had encouraged me to travel around Europe. And but I always approached life with I would say a greater than average work ethic, and a tremendous sense of, you know, sort of guilt if I wasn't educating and bettering myself.
Wow, those are amazing lessons, and they do sound like incredible people. Just your whole life just is, it should be made into a movie one day. It's such an incredible story. Thanks. And I wanted to move to your time in the military. So what made you join the military, and sort of what sort of led to that decision?
I knew I was going to join the military in like the second or third grade. Wow. I got a set of GI Joes, and that was it. I was like, I knew I wanted to join the Navy, and I knew I wanted to be a diver. And I didn't know how I was going to do that from the Appalachia, where there's no ocean, you know. Mm-hmm. But I in the fifth grade, I made a decision that I wasn't going to do homework anymore. I remember really clearly that year at my, you know, my teacher would give us homework, and I would nod and take the homework and just not do it. And that lasted for, you know, a month or so before I had to have a meeting with my mother at the school. and the teacher said, you know, your son's doing excellent at the in-class quizzes and exams, but if he doesn't do homework, he's barely going to pass. And he hasn't done any homework. And my mother, you know, looked at me and she said, well, what's this about? And I remember that was the first time I decided to, sort of stand up against a system. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I don't want to do that. I said, I think that if, I said, yeah, I understand that the truant law says I have to be in school, but, the truant law doesn't say I have to do the homework. And if you can't teach me what I need to learn in 8 hours, then it seems like that's your fault and I shouldn't have to go home and figure it out.
Wow.
And my mother kind of, shrugged, and she said, well, I know my son and his mind's made up. And so she said, what can we do about extra credit? So that was it. I spent the rest of my public school education doing no homework, doing well on quizzes and exams. I loved to be in the library. I just refused to take any work home. Mm-hmm. And so I barely passed high school, my SAT scores. In America, we have SATs, or like a placement exam for college. Mm-hmm. My SAT scores were better than average, but my grade point average was so low that that I wasn't going to go to school on a full ride. Mm-hmm. And I was tired of being at my parents' house, and I was tired of doing electrical work for my dad. And so I wasn't going to go continue doing that and going to community college. And so, and I already knew from, I don't know, I must have been, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old the first time I asked, what do I have to do in order to be able to join the Navy? And mm-hmm. the answer was, you have to not be arrested, and you have to and you have to pass high school. And so those were, that was it. And that mm-hmm. That was what I did. And I knew I was going to go see the world. I was going to live on a, I was going to live on a ship, and I was going to learn, you know, diving and parachuting. And I knew that that's what I, that was going to be my path. And I, there was all this other stuff that sort of influenced that. I was obsessed with Jacques Cousteau. I was obsessed with Japan. And I was, I also thought, like, I took a American civics class, and we talked about how much America spends on military. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, much more than anywhere else in the world, obviously. And I said, well, that's it. I mean, as if this is what our culture expresses itself as, you know, then if this is the thing that we, you know, hold most valuable, if this is our expression of culture, then I'm going to go get really good at that. Mm-hmm. And if, I don't know, if I'd been born in France and we spent more money on art and wine, I'd maybe work in a vineyard or a gallery, but we don't. So, that was that. I knew that I was going to go be the best, I could be at the thing that we do the best. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was why.
Awesome. And could you possibly tell us a few lessons that you learned in the military? Because I know that, you know, in general, people who go into the military, they come out a completely different person and completely mm-hmm. different molded. And so what were the biggest lessons that you learned in your time?
The biggest single lesson that I got out of it was a set of core values that was instilled in me. Mm-hmm. And it was instilled with, you know, uncountable numbers of pushups and hard discipline, but the core values were really, really simple. It was honor, courage, and commitment. And from the first day you get into the Navy or the Marine Corps into the last day that you're there, that's the newly accepted set of values that you will have. Mm-hmm. And I can't unlearn that, you know, I can't unwire that, and I wouldn't want to. And that drives me. That wakes me up in the morning. That gets my feet on the ground and keeps me pushing. You know, honor. I hold it more valuable than most anybody I know. And most people that I know think of it as kind of like, I don't know, a punchline, you know, to a joke. And mm-hmm. and to me, I just don't. You know, I aim to keep my honor fucking clean, mm-hmm. you know, and courage. I'm not going to back down from a fight ever, not ever, 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 you know, and I don't really know how to a fault at this point, you know, and commitment, you know, I'm not going to leave my comrades, my countrymen, my family, my friends. I'm not going to leave them behind, not ever. And yeah. So that set of core values is what, you know, the military is just a group of people who all just decide to think about things the same way at the same time. They agreed that they're all going to put their hand on the rope at the same time, and they're all going to equally pull as hard as they possibly fucking can at the same time. Mm. And part of that is a set of core values. And I think that honor, courage, and commitment is what makes me different than most Americans, and it's what makes me the same as all military. And it's the thing that those core values, that's the thing that we're all missing, that the Americans to my left and right, these, you know, civilian folks, that's the thing they're missing. They don't have a common agreed on set of core values. And the Navy and the Marine Corps, I had instructors who would get up earlier than me, and they would fuck up their personal relationships training me to work hard and to believe in a set of core values.
Mm.
And I ate chow that was paid for by taxpayers. I learned how to fucking kill anything that can walk and crawl with any weapon you can put in front of me. And those bullets were paid for by taxpayers. And I feel like I still owe my people. And I owe my brothers who are dead, who don't get to come home and make things better. Mm-hmm. And I hold those core values close to my heart, you know, and I will until I'm dead.
I love it. I love it. And I have in the past listened to a lot of, I don't know if you know this guy, Jocko Willink.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Incredible person.
I'm actually reading his book.
Wow. Awesome.
Extreme Ownership. Mm-hmm. I get a lot out of it, really.
Yeah.
I know some of the same people that he knows. I was working in Coronado in support of SEAL Team operations when I left the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to run over what you were going to say, but and we'll come back, but those SEALs were some of the most loyal brothers I ever had. Mm-hmm. You know, they turned a blind eye to some of my bullshit, you know, and they held me accountable, and I was, you know, I went down and worked in Coronado right after my mother died. And before she died, I was working for a Marine reconnaissance unit. And I had this really great set of brothers in Mexico who were there for me when she died, and who sent the biggest bouquet of flowers of anybody that I knew to my mom's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this this set of SEAL brothers who supported my business, who encouraged me, who helped me figure shit out, and they were there for me when I was finally done putting my mother to rest. If it hadn't been for those teammates, those shipmates, as bad as my sanity is now, I don't know that I would even be here. I don't think I would be here if it hadn't been for the support of those brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it absolutely, it seems like it's just the tightest bond as a community that you can have, you know, this group of people who literally would do anything for each other. And you know, what I was going to say is, you know, Jocko was talking once on this podcast about the fact that even though there are people in America who completely disagree with the system of military and all that it stands for, you don't necessarily have to agree with the purpose of the war to, at the same time, respect the soldiers, because the soldiers are these people who, for a certain amount of money every year, will drop anything at any time to go and do what the American people have asked them to do. And that's such an incredible thing. Like, what, because essentially what the military is supposed to fight for is the right to freedom and everything that America stands for. And so obviously that means that people can have whatever opinion they want, because that's what you guys are fighting for. And so obviously there are people out there who feel like the military is sort of like a cog in the system. What would you say to those sorts of people about, you know, maybe a little bit more about, what am I trying to say here? What the military actually represents, as opposed to help them to get a clearer representation.
Well, I think that I would challenge those people basically to either put up or shut up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, like, if you're not doing something to make this better, then I don't really think that you have a right to fucking complain.
Mm.
And I don't mean that you have to join the military. I mean, become a teacher. I mean, you know, go work for your congressman. Go work for your local politician. Go feed the homeless.
Mm.
Go if all you I was taught, you know, where I come from, I was taught that like complaining without a solution is just whining, mm-hmm. you know? And if you have a right to complain, if you are working to make it better. And if you're not, I don't know, I think that just falls into one of two categories. You're either lazy or you're a coward. Mm-hmm. That's it. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with all the things that we do as a nation, or that I agree with all the ways that you know, the global economic phenomenon of war occurs. I'm not, and I think that, like, I think that people think that we military people are so enlightened that we can't fucking see it from their perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's not it at all. In fact, like, I think I'm a bigger peacenik than most peacenicks, mm-hmm. because I've sopped up blood, you know, and mm-hmm. I've danced over landmines and I've buried my friends. And so I feel like there's a sense of, well, one, how dare you? How dare you think that, like, I don't get it? Mm-hmm. And the other point is, like, how dare you open your mouth and complain if you're not willing to work to make it better? Mm-hmm. And that kind of entitlement and apathy, that that burns me up, you know?
Well, I think that's honestly one thing that I believe in heavily right now, is that this idea that if you complain, but you at the same time don't have a solution, or you're not working towards a better situation, then that is completely pointless. That's just my personal view. And I feel like in general, there are a lot of complainers out there, not a lot of doers out there. And and I think sometimes the voices of the complainers tends to overshadow the voices of the doers. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to get your perspective on that. And I also, go on.
There was something that was told to me, when I was at a recon unit. Marine reconnaissance is sort of the Marine special operations, you know, portion of the group, you know? Mm-hmm. And, in recon, they would say, a recon man can speak volumes without speaking a word. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm less and less interested in the days, especially in the time of like social media and Twitter and blah blah blah. I'm so uninterested in the blah blah blah, mm-hmm. and I'm so much more interested in like your deeds, not your words.
Yeah,
you know? And that's, you know, this podcast is lovely, but don't judge me by my words. Just judge me by my deeds.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love it. And I wanted to know, so you obviously built this incredible character going through the military, and you built this bond between all of these people who became your best friends. They would do anything for you. And I was wondering, is there anything that regular civilians can do to sort of build these characteristics for themselves, or build this community without having to join the military? Because I just feel like it's something so special that you guys have in this institution. And like, for example, I have on this podcast talked to a couple of people and good friends of mine, like Joe Iannetti, who survived cancer. Mm-hmm. And he, after surviving cancer, has this incredible perspective on life. And I wonder, how can you even get that kind of perspective on life without Sure. going through this ordeal of surviving cancer? And so I asked him that. What would you say to people about how they can develop the characteristics of a military person, you know, without having to join the military?
Well, I think the benefit of the military is that it's a community of like-minded folks, Hmm. right? But I think that, like, you know, and I think that, you know, I've said before that the thing that makes soldiers into soldiers first is that they voluntarily agree to serve, and they suffer together as a group. Now, I guess what I'm really saying is that, like, you need to find your community, you know, and you need to figure out how committed you're willing to be, how honorable you're going to be, and how courageous you'll fight for them. But, you know, you brought up, you know, the man with cancer. What was his name?
Joe Unity.
Okay. And Joe, I would imagine, was faced with his own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a really good place to start personally before we even speak to community. I took with me to Afghanistan. I took one book with the intention of others being delivered to me, and that worked out well.
Mm-hmm.
But the book I took with me was the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about, you know, really meditating on your mortality. And I would challenge folks who are looking for that character that Joe has, or looking for that character that warriors have, I would challenge them to meditate on their own death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I could pull you, I play this time machine game sometimes, you know, where I'll say, why don't you climb into the time machine with me? And we're going to fast forward in life to the day of your death. And you and I are going to have a conversation with you on your deathbed.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it is, when you really meditate on this, whatever it is that you think you're going to regret then, you should get the fuck on the ball and work on that right now.
Mm.
I want to be remembered as a hard worker. I want to be remembered as someone who gave back. I want to be remembered as, my mother would say, leave it better than you found it. You know,
mm-hmm.
And if you're not ready to die in peace by way of the way that you're living right now, then you need to fix that. And I think people live in this willful denial of their own mortality. You know, and I just I've buried enough people, I've narrowly missed enough death that, like, I just don't live like that. And when you're truly intimate with your own mortality, when you've really shaken hands with your own Reaper Man, and you've really talked to yourself on your deathbed, you'll find that there comes a sense of urgency. There comes a sense of maybe purpose. And I think that when you're there, it's actually a really beautiful thing. Most people are too afraid to really look at it, but it's a really beautiful thing. When I was meditating on my own death in Afghanistan every day, it allowed me to jock up and move forward without a very much fear at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that all the letters that I needed to write had already been written and sent. I knew that I would pack my gear in such a way that if I die today, there's no mess for you to clean up. It's already boxed up. And I would finish my cup of water every night. And in this Tibetan Buddhist, you know, tradition, I would turn the cup upside down next to my cot every night, so that if I died in my sleep, there's that much less to clean up.
Hmm.
And you live your life 60 minutes lived out of every hour, full intention on everything you do, no matter how small. If this is going to be the last time I get to tie my shoes, I'm going to fucking tie those boots perfect.
Hmm.
If this is the last time I'm going to get to fucking clean my rifle, it's going to be spotless. And I'm going to move forward with an intention of not dying, of killing the motherfucker who would want to kill me, taking care of my teammates, but being at total peace if it is my time to die. And I think if you're asking me, what is it that other people could do? It would be get used to the idea that you're going to fucking die.
Mm-hmm.
And pay the fuck attention to the life you have while you're still here, and live it as hard as you can. Give it everything you got. Love as hard as you can love, and fight as hard as you can fight. So that, like, when it's finally your time to die, there's no regrets. There was nothing left. no energies left that you didn't expend. I want to go down with bloody knuckles and empty weapon magazines. I want to shoot every bullet that I've got, and I want to keep punching until it's over.
Wow, that was awesome. And I think everybody should go back a couple of minutes and listen to that again and again, because I think that that's so important. It sounds, I'm going to say this for selfish reasons, because I have been studying Stoicism a lot lately. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the core principles of Stoicism is that you should constantly remember that someday you will die. And it's not a negative thing to do that, because by remembering that you're going to die, you will actually remind yourself to truly live. And I completely agree that there are some people out there who are just so worried about the fact that someday they're going to die. And I feel like this worry is coming from a place that actually represents how they feel about the way that they're living their life right now. They feel like they're leaving a lot on the table, and so they don't want to die like that. And I love this whole philosophy that you're bringing to the table right now, which is, you know, if you really want to live an incredible life, you've got to remember that one day you will die, because that means that you really need to make the most of every second and every minute that you have on this earth right now. I love that. So thank you so much for sharing all that.
You're welcome.
And I want to ask you if you could tell us about a time that you overcame something that was really troubling you or hurting you, or overcame something that was really tough for you, and how did you get through that?
I think, well, most recently I got sober, and that was hard for me. And, you know, I had a lot of, it felt like loose change rattling around in the fucking, in the floorboards of my mind, you know, and it was time to sort of collect all that rattling noise up and sort of deal with something, cash it out and do something with it, you know? And, I would say that, in all things, I think that my greatest motivator is love. And, you know, I think that, like, you know, I don't know what, you know, Jocko or the next, pipe hitting swinging dick will fucking tell you. But like, at the end of the day, I think that, like, you know, we fight for the things that we love. And so that's my major motivator, you know, is love, you know, love for family, love for country. And at the end of the day, figuring out love for self, you know? And, yeah, I think that's an underrepresented motivation is the power of love, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of which, I mean, when you came out of the military, you came back and you saw that all of these problems that you thought you were fighting for, they weren't solved yet. And there were still hungry people. There were still people who'd just come out of the military, veterans who didn't have great jobs. And that's what I love about Maxwell Soaps so much is the fact that you didn't just stop at, okay, we're going to help people who are homeless by giving them soap every time somebody buys a soap. You also said, okay, now we're also going to help the veterans. These are my people. These are my brothers. You know, let's help them to get really good jobs. And I absolutely love that. And so first of all, thank you so much for being that kind of person, for, you know, who actually does take action. It's an incredible company. What really motivated you the most to start this company?
Well, I think it's, you know, so before I became a corpsman, I was an intelligence specialist. I was a mission planner. I was a think tank soldier, and you know, highly cerebral stuff. And my motivation was problem solving from the earliest. You know, that's really what I'm doing. It just so happens that this problem is a glaring problem, an undeniable problem that's close to my heart. But if once this problem is solved, I'll just go on to solving other problems. Mm-hmm. And that's my biggest motivator right now. I mean, I'll tell you a secret, but like, I'm starting a nonprofit, and mm-hmm. the intention is to is to purchase a retired Navy ship and turn it into an all-inclusive rehab center for homeless veterans.
Wow. And
that's the newest thing on the plate. I was doing homeless outreach in Hollywood for a while. Mm-hmm. And I approached it thinking, you know, I can solve these problems. I figure these things out. I can put the right resources and touch the right people. And it turns out there's actually a lot of learned helplessness within those communities. I think there's a lot of enabling mm-hmm. that really occurs, you know, where giving somebody a hot meal or a cup of coffee, it just keeps them in the same place they were, you know, before you gave them the hot cup of coffee and the hot meal. Now, I'm not saying don't feed people. I'm saying, like, if you're not willing to really approach this in a holistic, you know, that is to say, all-encompassing kind of way, and really deal with mental health issues and really deal with issues of long-term shelter and physical medical needs and on employment, then you're given a half effort, you know, at mm-hmm. best. And I think that, like, for me, I guess I'm a problem solver, and I want to create something that is innovative in a space that is pretty stale and hopeless, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that moving forward with this operation, we're calling it Operation Redemption. I think that we can make a real and lasting permanent change for folks, you mm-hmm. know, for especially for our veterans who are living outside in the street. I mean, it sits like a thorn in my side. It sits like a splinter in my mind. The idea that a guy can jock up and go overseas and fight violently for providing the power that this nation has to wield across the planet, and then that you could come home and somehow end up sleeping outside. Mm-hmm. Like, the only reason this country even exists is because this dude went over and fucked shit up for you, mm-hmm. you know? And the idea that, like, he could come home and not have shelter because he's so crazy from doing the work that we've asked him to do, that's a problem I aim to fix.
Mm. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I love that. And what would you say that the average person can do to make this situation better, both for homelessness and also for veterans?
Mm-hmm. I'd say open your mind and exist in the question. Understand that you probably don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the judgment that you're passing on people, especially those folks who are living outside, that is probably altogether wrong. I thought I knew what I was talking about, but mm-hmm. I opened up my mind. I opened up my heart. I got out into the streets and I started really helping people really get off the corner, really get out of the tent, really get into shelters, really get into, you know, long-term, you know, housing situations. And I was blown away at how wrong I was. One of the common misconceptions people have is homeless people are all drug addicts. Mm-hmm. That's kind of true, but not really. And this is what I found out. It's like they probably ended up homeless because they probably had some mental issues to begin with. They were probably expressed. That was probably expressed with self-medicating using drugs. And they, you know, they burned the bridges with their family and friends until they ended up outside. But once they're really full-time homeless, there's no budget to have a serious drug issue. Mm-hmm. There isn't the budget. Like, you can't panhandle enough to cover the dollar menu at McDonald's plus a full-time drug habit. Those there's just not enough money out there. And I'm talking about some of the most lucrative corners you can work in Southern California, like Hollywood and Highland. People are giving you money all the time. Mm-hmm. It's beyond the cost. It inhibits their survival. Mm-hmm. So like I was talking to a guy and I was like, are you you're really not using anymore? And he's like, well, look, I have been an addict before and I have used once or twice this month. But for the most part, like I couldn't keep up a serious drug habit and still survive out here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I just never really saw. And I was working in Coronado, working for SEAL teams. And one of the things that I was doing was I was providing medical coverage for those young guys going through BUDS and Hell Week, you know, basic underwater demolition school. Hell Week is what you've seen in movies and all of that. You know, they keep these guys up for a week, or they keep these guys up for a solid week, and they just beat the dog shit out of them, right? Mm-hmm. And the Navy and their instructors are really, really clever. They use the elements to beat these guys into submission. Mm-hmm. So out into the surf, and then back out and running with logs and boats on your head until you're so hot and tired, then back into the water, and then back out into the wind, into the sand, into the surf, over and over and over again, mm-hmm. denying these guys sleep. And the only real rest they get is as they're sitting down, shoveling, 3,000, 4,000 calories of food into their mouth every day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what came to me when I was working with, a guy named Chris, who is the original Superman character on Hollywood Boulevard who ended up homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him one day and we started working together, working his case together. And eventually, he had my phone number and I was helping him figure out his situation. But he was outside during a really long and rare rainy season last year, freezing to death. And I was so convinced that he was still using, and he wasn't. And it turned out that like he was just so sleep deprived, so calorie deficient, no real vitamins, and always being beat up by the weather, that the similarities between what I was seeing in him as a patient and what I was seeing in those guys at Hell Week was exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, he never had enough sleep because dealers were always waking him up to sell him drugs.
Mm-hmm.
He never had enough sleep because he was always worried someone's going to steal his shit. He never had any security because he was worried someone's going to kick his ass. And that's both, law enforcement when he acts out or other homeless folks who want something that he doesn't want to give up. He's only eating the dollar menu at McDonald's. I mean, how crazy would you be if I fucked with your sleep for just a couple weeks?
Mm.
We don't even do that to our Navy guys, the strongest and the youngest of the volunteers who are trying to be SEALs. We don't do that to them for more than a week. Mm-hmm. And these homeless people are doing this for months at a time, essentially putting themselves through Hell Week. They're either burning up on the sidewalk in a hot ass tent, or they're freezing on the sidewalk every night. Mm-hmm. They're being woke up by police or other criminals or other homeless people. So they're never getting real sleep. There's no folic acid or real nutritional value in the food they're putting into their mouths. And then we wonder, why is this person acting crazy? Well, no fucking shit. Like, you'd be crazy if I just took the sleep away from you. Mm-hmm. And then we say, well, why is this person using street drugs? No fucking shit. I don't know anybody who could handle that without going crazy. I don't mm-hmm. know anybody who could handle that without self-medicating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have this sense of denial and we have this sense of avoidance of this problem because, frankly, we all know that there but by the grace of God go I. Mm-hmm. Everybody I know mostly is living paycheck to paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody I know mostly is only one or maybe two good crises away from being exactly where that person is.
Yeah.
And that's why we make them invisible. Is because we don't want to look at ourselves in those people's eyes. That's why.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing all that. And there's just so many great things to think about there. And it's tough there. There are a lot of people who really are. Well, I feel like most people including myself, are just completely detached from the realities of what some other people have to go through. And what would you say that people can do to develop greater empathy towards those people who just have so much less than they do? Like, what would you say that people can do in America?
Start by putting yourself in their position, you know? And I think, you know, start by having some empathy. Mm-hmm. Start by not being so judgmental and sure of your judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Start by recognizing that those are your fellow man. Those are your fellow Americans. Those are your fucking neighbors, actually. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the longer you leave that person to twist in the fucking wind, the more likely they're going to get sick and make you sick. The more likely they're going to get desperate and steal from you.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're able to really open your mind and open your heart to that, I think that, you know, the how you're going to help, that'll become easy. You'll figure that part out. You'll figure out what church is doing the right thing. You'll figure out what city council member is doing the right thing. You'll figure out what meetings to go to. You'll figure out how to volunteer. And there's lots of opportunities for that. Like, just, you know, the there's every year, at least in Los Angeles, there's an effort to just count the homeless, to get out there and do a census of who's out there, why they're out there, and what they've got going on. You know, I mean, just those issues of just, you know, that scientific method of just identifying what the phenomenon is by being able to count it and quantify it. Like, just that alone is huge. Like, without the data, how do we really make how do we make change? How do we make difference? So, like, that alone is actually huge. The effort to just volunteer to help count the homeless. Yeah. After that, get out to clothing and food drives, get down to the shelters, figure out how you can participate, how you can volunteer, and start talking to your local and I guess national political representatives about what efforts are currently going on and how do you make a difference, how do you affect change, how do you support those efforts.
Awesome. And I only had a few more questions that I want to ask. It might be going in a different direction, but I wanted to know, what do you think is a great use of time and what do you think is a complete waste of time?
Wow. A great use of time, I think, is... I think a great use of time is... is actually meditation and self-work. Mm-hmm. I think finding the time that most people don't to work on yourself and get your mind right, I think that's a really undervalued, fantastic use of time. I think that if you're really going to affect change, if you're really going to help, if you're really going to be good for others, you probably got to start actually by getting your own shit together, you know, and finding your own center, you know. What do I think is a waste of time? Doing shit that doesn't make you happy so that you can have shit that you don't need. Yeah, I think that being a worker drone in a system that you don't actually feel truly served by, I think that's a tremendous waste of time. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Awesome. Is there anything that you wish that you'd been taught, but you had to learn yourself?
Gosh, is there anything I wish I'd been taught that? That's a good question.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. But I've got, there is. I wish that, you know, I think people had tried to teach me, but I was maybe resistant to it. Self-care and self-love. I wish I'd been taught a greater amount of prioritization of self. You know, I think that I learned really well how to sacrifice for the team. I don't really know that I was necessarily trained very well in how to, I guess, sacrifice in a way that would take care of me. Does that make sense? And I think, I'm learning now that if you want to get the most mileage out of yourself, you've got to do your own, you know, preventative maintenance. You've got to do your own periodic maintenance scheduling yourself. You've got to baby yourself in your mind in some ways. You've got to learn how to self-love. And I think that that was a lesson that was a long time coming that I'm just really getting around the corner on, you know.
Well, yeah, I think it's just so important for people to recognize that if you can't help yourself and if you can't build your own mind to a place where it needs to be, then there's no way that you can help other people to the full extent that you want to. And I think that's a great lesson from you. I mean, you've spent this time in the military developing your mind, developing your strengths and building this incredible character. And now you come out of the military and you've spent your whole life developing yourself. And now you are really killing it in this incredible business that is helping so many people. And I feel like if you didn't spend the amount of time that you did working on yourself and giving yourself the attention that you need, you wouldn't be at the stage where you need to be able to help so many people like you do. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
And this next question, this is absolutely a crazy question. It's the question that is tackled by all people throughout all of time. But what has been most important to you in terms of happiness? What do you think brings the most happiness in life?
Oh, love. That for me is an easy one.
Yep.
You know, you know, to feel connection and kinship and partnership and family, to feel needed and to need someone. You know, I think the Blues Brothers would say, "Everybody needs somebody to
classic
love."
Classic movie.
Yeah,
classic.
Man.
Yeah.
That's. I think above all, that's the truth that I know to be true. You know, is love.
Awesome. Yeah. And this question is a little bit weird, but if you could bring one historical figure back to life and meet them for a day, who would that be and why?
Oh. I'd like to meet Miyamoto Musashi. He was the most stoic samurai that ever was. And he wrote, "The way of the warrior is the resolute acceptance of death." And like, he was this ultimate badass. And I'd like to meet and train with him. I'd like to bring back Musashi and have tea with him. I mean, everybody's gonna say Gandhi, right? Or everybody's gonna say JFK, or that's cool. But as a singular, most impactful person in my philosophy, like my favorite Stoic, yeah, Musashi.
Awesome. And I wanted to know, so obviously you're a very well-read person. You're currently reading Jocko Willink's book. That's awesome. Like, what what are some books that you recommend that we could read that would sort of give us a bit of a perspective into your own philosophies?
Let's see. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that cover to cover a few times. I'm reading it again right now. Robert Heinlein's books. I'm a science fiction geek mm-hmm. at the end of the day. My mother read Strange in a Strange Land when she was pregnant with me, and I think Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers and Have Spacesuit Will Travel really impacted me to get out and see the world and, mm-hmm. and serve my country. Books that I mean, The Book of Five Rings, that's a pretty seminal piece of warrior philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Books that I would recommend. That's my list right now.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. And for those who are listening, I'll put those books and the links to where you can get them in the show notes of the podcast. Now, so as you know, this whole podcast is about finding people who really are inspiring to other people. And they don't have to have millions of followers. They don't have to have billions of dollars. They just have to be really great people who we can look up to. So what are the habits or characteristics that you see in people who inspire you?
I'm inspired by people who have enough sense to pay attention to the details and who can, you know, pump their brakes long enough to take care, you know. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds, I don't know, it's not dumb, but like making up my bed every morning, just like having that pause and that attention to detail does so much for me. And like really managing my morning routine, I think is managing my morning routine and those who do, and actually those who do it even better than I do. I've got friends that I look up to who I think of as being even more successful than me,
mm-hmm.
just because they're able to get up a little bit early and get a little bit more done than I am before lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that like how you, I had a therapist who said, you know, how you manage your morning sets up how you're going to manage the whole rest of your day.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if you find yourself rushed and slipping and stressed out before you even got out the door, then it's going to reflect in the rest of your day. And that's so true. You know, you come out of the door with a shitty morning routine, and you've got, you know, an hour after you're at work before you're able to even really get your mind right. At least I mm-hmm. do. You know, you're just recovering from the stress of the morning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that like those people who are, you know, able to really manage their time well, you know, I think it was Benjamin Franklin, right? Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise.
Mm.
I think that people who are actually able to manage their sleep, you know, I envy them. I want to emulate them. I have friends who, you know, get up at 5 and get to bed at 8.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's and they still manage to get everything done. They manage to make it to the gym. They make up their bed. You know, bills are paid. You know, vehicles are maintained. All that. Like those people who are able to really pay attention to detail. That's what I'm shooting for. Yeah.
Mm. And I like that because going to bed at 8 o'clock and waking up at 5 o'clock, that's actually a lot of sleep that you get. But it's mm-hmm. it doesn't matter because a lot of people feel like they have to, you know, if they want to be more productive, they have to get less sleep. But I mean, it's not necessarily how you spend your time sleeping; it's how you spend your time awake, right? And so,
right.
And that's really awesome that you have these people who can they can have that amount of sleep and still get everything that they need done in the day. Yep. I was going to go to the last question, but I have to ask you: could you tell us about your morning routine?
Yeah. Morning routine is when it's working and it's working right, right?
Yep.
is get up at 6:15, make up the bed, or tuck my girl back into bed, and I'll either make it to the gym or out to the garage to either lift my kettlebell or to do some running and lifting weights at the gym. Protein shakes and making breakfast for children. No, whatsoever. No, phone, email, social media, Instagram, like no beeps and chirps and none of that shit in the mornings, you know, and dedicating the morning to myself and family, taking the kids over to school, and they have a mindful meditation at the kids' school, which is something I really look forward to. It's just a couple minutes, and that's on top of the meditation I've already done for the day. But you know, the kids will stand in silence for 1 minute, for 60 seconds, and they'll concentrate on a given piece of advice or maxim or whatever. And I feel like if I can manage healthy breakfast, early wake up, exercise, making up the bed, brushing teeth, if I can manage to get all of that done, and have the kids there at school by 7 o'clock, I know that there's a much better chance than average that I'm gonna have a winning day, you know. And if I find myself hungover, in a rush, sleeping through an alarm clock, eating crap food or skipping food, then that's a better than average chance I'm setting myself up for failure, you know.
And once again, I was going to go to that last question, but I have to dig deeper into this because I just think that there's so much value in your morning routine. There's three things that I wanted to ask about. Firstly, what is the benefit that you have seen from turning off your phone and your notifications in the morning? Because I know that at the moment I'm in a terrible habit, even though I know that some of, like the best people in their field in every career have all said, oh yeah, I wake up and I don't turn on my phone. I just go about my day because it's so important. But I'm in this terrible habit of getting up straight to the email, straight to Facebook. It's horrible. What are the benefits that you see from turning off your notifications every morning?
Well, to begin with, like, you are not your fucking job, right? You are, I quote little Fight Club, you're not your khakis, you're not the money in your pocket, you're not, you are not, you are you. And the workday starts when the workday starts. And I think that the benefit of me turning off all the bells and chirps and all that is I can actually have a clean meditative morning. You know, Gandhi said, you know, I meditate every morning for 1 hour, except when I'm really busy. And then I meditate for two. So I think,
Awesome.
right. So like, you know, I think that you need to figure out a way to unplug. And it's so pervasive in 2017, you know, this, these devices constantly like better and better designed by smarter and smarter, you know, anatomists and psychologists and product developers to just get your attention at any cost. You know, it's like, it's get a fucking alarm clock and just completely turn off the phone, you know, and have some solace and some peace from the battle that you're fighting for work, for money, for the difference you're trying to make. Like, you should still have some solace. And I think that, like, you know, greeting the morning and remembering that you're not this job, and that you're you, and you're this family, and you're this home, and you're these people that you care about. It for me, it aligns myself with my real purpose. It aligns me with the things that really make me happy. It aligns me back with me. If the world should crumble and fall, and the networks all go down and your job disappears, well, who the fuck were you anyway? Like, that's what I'm trying to keep in mind in my mornings. You know, and I think that doing it the other way leads to being ungrounded, and it leads me to sort of anxiously chasing my own tail. And fuck that noise. Like, there's this, it just ain't worth it at the end of the day. And I think, you know, you have to have, how do I say this? You have to have the balls to stand up for yourself and your own life. You know, and I think that if that includes me turning off this fucking phone in the mornings. Until kids are delivered to school, the phone doesn't come on. I don't have to talk to anybody, period. That's it. And people can either get used to it or they can fuck off.
Love it.
That's it.
Absolutely love it. And what does your meditation routine look like? And what have been the benefits in your life? Is that something that you picked up in the military, or did you just come to that by yourself?
Right. So a little bit going back against what I was just saying, I actually, I used to only just do a silent meditation, sort of a Zazen sort of position, you know, quieting your mind, centering your chakras, all of that. And what I've come to now is I actually, there is an electronic version of the brainwave programming that I use now. I don't want to drop any brand names one way or the other, but like it's basically binaural beats that send a brainwave frequency sound. Are you familiar with this technology?
I'm not, no.
Oh my God, you got to get into this. It's so good.
All right, you got to tell us all about it.
So your brain, if you were to put in an MRI or if you were to put your brain under the electrodes that detect brainwave frequency, well, scientists, you know, this isn't really new technology, but scientists have been able to take that particular brainwave that you have when you're at peace or when you're in deep theta wave, deep REM sleep. They can take those brainwave patterns and they can turn that into a sound. And then they can take that sound, and it just sounds like a frequency, whatever. And it sounds like a frequency. You put it into headphones, and you play that sound back into your mind, into your brain as you're meditating. And it sort of it sends your brain into those states of being while you're meditating. Now, I got turned on to this just before I left Afghanistan. And then I downloaded this into an iPod, and when I would have a moment in Afghanistan to myself, and it was time to meditate, I would put this in, and it would trick your brain basically going into like a deep REM state. Almost, I wouldn't say instantly, but within minutes, you would be there. You know, and then they'll play white noise or guided meditation on top. Now, because I can do that with airplane mode on, I feel like it's not a cheat in the morning. But yeah, that's one of my favorites. The other is I get a lot of meditation out of I'll get over to the beach, and this is without, you know, device. I'll get over to the beach and I'll do a long run. And when I'm fully spent at like, I don't know, I can get like 3 miles in, then I'll sit in the sand, let the sun rise. At this point, my body will be nice and warm. Let the sun rise and the waves crash. That's a pretty choice place to be in my meditation. And then I have two other spots that I squirrel off to. One is the balcony and one is the garage. And yeah, I just find a quiet space and no less than 5 minutes and usually no more than 15.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I'm definitely going to check all that out because that sounds really interesting. And
It's like brain hacking, you know?
absolutely. And I think there's just so much that we don't yet understand about the brain, but we're really getting into exciting times where so much new technology is coming out and so much new information is coming out about, you know, how powerful our brains actually are and how much we can actually, you know, control them, be that with you know, a device like that and those brain frequencies or other means. But it's really exciting times for all the, of this sort of stuff. And you did mention earlier kettlebells. Now, I've been getting into them and absolutely have seen incredible benefits. For those people out there who don't yet know about kettlebell training, why do you choose to use kettlebells?
Okay. Well, because it's hard. And I'm convinced that if it's hard, then it's probably good. I bought my kettlebell maybe 10 years ago now, and I've named him Igor. And it's a plug ugly cannonball with a handle on it, as you know. And I think that, you know, between a pull up bar, which I made my own pull up bar, between a pull up bar and a kettlebell, you kind of don't need any more gym. And a long time ago, I got into the habit of taking my kettlebell in the trunk of the car everywhere I go. And what I'll do is, you're in Australia, yeah? But like, you understand that Los Angeles is world famous for traffic. And so what I'll do is, instead of sitting in traffic, I'll just pull off and take off whatever work clothes I'm wearing, put on my sneakers, and park the truck. And I'll do, you know, a mile and a half to 3 miles of running, and then circle back to the truck in whatever parking lot I'm at. And people will give me looks like I'm a fucking crazy maniac, but I'll just start lifting my kettlebell right there at the side of the truck until I'm either spent or traffic is complete. And so I like it because it's an all-inclusive one-piece gym, and I can do more variations of effective, you know, of effective working style lifting than I could with any other one single piece. I like it because there's no moving parts, there's nothing to lose, there's no bits to, you know, have to look for. And I just imagine like old Russian soldiers fighting on the Eastern Front, and you know, some truck pulls up and here's your gym, comrade. And they just kick off kettlebells and there you go. I love it. It keeps you move at a cardio, you know, pace, but you're moving with weight. You know, Pavel Tsatsouli or some other Russian was saying that it saves you from the embarrassment of cardio. It makes you strong. Everything from grip strength to posture, and it works everything. You know, I mean, you feel the muscles in the plantar surfaces of your feet from gripping the ground. You feel calves, you feel quads, you feel butt, shoulders, back, arms, everything. You know, it's an all over workout depending on how you want to throw the bell around.
Awesome. And as if you haven't already provided enough value to all of us, I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to ask you for an idea of like what your kettlebell workout looks like. And it would probably be pointless to talk about that here, but every workout, it probably doesn't look like what it sounds like. But I'd love to find out that. But I just had one more question for you before we say goodbye. And the question is this: if you could send one text message to everybody in the world, what would you say?
Don't quit. Easy. Don't quit. Don't quit. I think that, you know, the graveyard is rich with ideas that never got executed. It's full of boundless love that was never expressed. It's just full of a bunch of people who were often scared and gave up early, you know, and like then they went to their grave and they had regret that they quit, whatever that thing is, whatever that dream is, you know, don't be afraid to dream a little fucking bigger, you know? And don't quit. That's the advice I would always give.
I love it. And Max, thank you so much for coming on the show. I mean, we've just spent almost an hour and a half talking, and I'm so grateful for you giving this time, because I just know that everything that we've talked about here, you've just given so much value, and I just know that there are so many incredible lessons to be taken out of this podcast right here. And is there anything else that you wanted to say to the audience before we say goodbye?
No, I really do thank you all for listening to me. I'm humbled that you would ask, and love each other. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Have an amazing day, and we'll talk soon.
I will. Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Max. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Searching for Good podcast. I hope that I've added a little bit of value into your day, and I hope that this podcast is helping you to live an incredible life. For more episodes, or for blog posts and many more free resources, just go to searchingforgoodpodcast.com. If you know somebody who's influenced you and you'd like to hear them on the podcast, just go to the contact page and send me an email.